This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The September 11th, 2001 attacks provided the spark for a multi-front war crafted by President George W. Bush and maintained by President Barack Obama to now evolve into the longest war the U.S. has ever fought. From Afghanistan to Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and today Syria, there seems to be no end in sight and no end goal to this war. In spite of Mr. Obama's vain lip service for ending the war every now and then, we have a new and terrifying bogeyman to focus the war efforts on, the Islamic State. In his new book, Spiral, author Mark Danner writes, quote, "We have created in the war on terror a perpetual motion machine." Mark Danner is a writer and foreign policy analyst, contributor to the New York Review of Books and New York Times Magazine. He's a former staff writer at The New Yorker and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you, Sonali. It's good to be on.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I really appreciate the eloquence of your writing. And so I just feel like I want to quote from your book to begin with and several times during this interview to set the stage. Of course, the September 11th attacks were the impetus for what we're seeing today. And you write in your book, like a celestial slot machine daily pouring forth its golden bounty, the September 11th attacks had led the administration of President George W. Bush not only to an assault on Afghanistan, but scarcely a year later to a wonderfully telegenic invasion of a major Muslim country, which of course was Iraq. The September 11th attacks, in those attacks, thousands of Americans died. But since then, you point out repeatedly in your book that only a handful, a vanishingly small number of Americans have died at the hands of Islamic terrorists since we launched the war. So when we put it in that context, why is that a problem? You know, the supporters of the war might say that means the war is a success.
Well, that's true, although in other ways it's been a rather dramatic failure. And that is that if you consider that the war is supposed to end the threat to American security and reduce the number of jihadists who cite the United States as their central target, their central enemy, then the war has been a dramatic failure because the number of jihadists has increased exponentially since September 11th. At the time, the U.S. faced a terrorist group in al-Qaeda of a couple thousand members. Now there are tens of thousands in the Islamic State, which is a second worldwide terrorist group that considers the United States its key enemy. The number of groups has increased dramatically, according to a well-known RAND study and other studies of this issue. And in effect, the number of attacks worldwide has increased, according to the figures from the United States State Department, 4,000% since 2002. Last year, there were on the order of 32,000 terrorist attacks around the world. It's true that the U.S. tactics, drone warfare and other tactics, to some degree have prevented attacks on the homeland. My argument really is that, first of all, this will not last forever, which we've seen quite recently. And secondly, that because we're increasing the number of terrorist groups, the number of terrorists, and also the will to fight the United States, inevitably there will be more attacks and this problem will be never ending. And they're therefore a perpetual motion machine, as you quoted from Spiral.
So let's actually go through the motions of how one thing feeds into another and then feeds right back into itself. When we talk about the fallout of the U.S. wars in any one of the number of countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever, every time the U.S. kills, say, civilians or very unjustly wreaks violence upon the inhabitants of a city or country, it gives impetus, it gives more motivation, more inspiration, more recruits to the very groups that the U.S. is claiming to fight against. But that in turn, the growing numbers of recruits in turn then feed the U.S. More and more. Is that essentially what you're talking about in the title of your book, Spiral?
Yes. Spiral, of course, is a motion where you have a circling, something circling around a central point and getting ever farther and farther away from that central point. So the war on terror is a spiral in that we're getting farther and farther away from the goal, which should be to decrease and eventually end the terrorist threat. And what you've described is called by the terrorists themselves and others the strategy of provocation. It goes back certainly to September 11th attacks themselves, when the purpose of al-Qaeda in those attacks was to provoke the United States to invade a Muslim country. They thought the United States would invade Afghanistan and would sink into a quagmire. And the theory was the jihadists, the mujahideen, would fight the United States in the Afghan mountains, destroy U.S. military as they had, so the theory went, destroyed the Soviet military more than a decade before. And they would defeat the United States and end its status as a superpower, just as they did to the Soviet Union. That was the theory. In the event, the United States invaded Iraq, which in some ways was even more propitious, more favorable to al-Qaeda, because the U.S. instituted an occupation that turned out to be very bloody, that provided enormous publicity against the United States, you know, film of the U.S. suppressing Muslims, invading Muslim houses, throwing Muslim men on the ground, putting their boots, the troops putting their boots on the backs of Muslims as they lay on the ground. Also, the photographs from Abu Ghraib prison, the photographs from Guantanamo detention center in Cuba, all of this enormously helped jihadist recruiting because in essence, their theory is the U.S. is the repressor of Muslims, but in general, it does it through its client states. It did it through the Mubarak regime in Egypt at the time, through the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia and other client states, so that the occupation of Iraq represented the U.S. suddenly tearing off its mask and actually suppressing Muslims directly. And this allowed them to increase their call for Muslims to come and fight with them as jihadists. The organization grew, and notably, the Islamic State, then called al-Qaeda in Iraq, sprang up in the wake of the occupation during the summer of 2003. So the strategy of provocation is essentially to provoke the United States into doing things, notably invading and occupying Iraq, that are directly contrary to its self-interest. And part of my argument in Spiral is that the United States has consistently walked into that trap and done these things that the Islamic State, that al-Qaeda originally and the Islamic State now wanted the United States to do to help it grow in power, grow in influence, grow in membership.
And so it has been, in a way, astonishingly easy then to keep the U.S. fighting, to keep it spiraling, and our own military-industrial complex seems to have been only too happy to also continue to have a reason for extra funding. But going back to the numbers of Americans that have been killed since September 11th, after that horrific attack, only handfuls of numbers of Americans being killed if you don't count U.S. soldiers. But then the numbers of people, civilians and others that the U.S. has killed in all these various countries, you know, not just a war with one country, but just a growing number of countries, has been quite staggering. Can you give us a sense of the human cost of the spiraling forever war?
Well, the numbers, as you say, are rather staggering. The United States, the American people don't pay much attention to this. These are deaths that are going on far from American shores. But in fact, you know, we're talking about wars that have killed hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of people. Most Americans don't know that in the first couple of weeks of the Iraq war, the so-called shock and awe strategy, bombing and then invading Iraq, the lowest, the most reliable estimate of civilian deaths in Iraq during those couple of weeks is 3,240 of just civilians who died in the first couple of weeks. If you were watching television in the United States during those weeks, you saw really no civilian deaths. You saw no dead civilians. But in fact, it was a particularly lethal period of time for Iraqi bystanders. And we're not talking about soldiers here or in uniform. We're talking about civilians. The number of deaths during the Iraq War, the estimates range from 160 to 170,000 civilians to over a million. And these are fairly reliable estimates. I would say a couple hundred thousand is a very conservative estimate of those who died in Iraq during that time. We're talking about tens of thousands of dead in Afghanistan as well. Drone warfare has killed about 5,000. The best estimates are, that estimate comes from Senator Lindsey Graham, who's on the Senate Armed Forces, Armed Services Committee. So we are talking about hundreds of thousands of people who have died in these wars. Most of them are not Americans. They're Iraqis, they're Afghans, they're Somalis, they're Yemenis, they're Pakistanis, and so on. But you're talking about a great many dead.
Which all, of course, feeds into the recruitment efforts of groups like Al-Qaeda, of the Islamic State. The other aspect of the US war that has very strongly fed into the motivations of these groups is Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all of those instances of torture, or what the US has liked to euphemistically say enhanced interrogation techniques. The Islamic State in particular has very effectively and terrifyingly used the same imagery of the orange-clad jumpsuits of their prisoners to echo what the U.S. did and is continuing to do to prisoners in Guantanamo. How important an aspect of this war on terror has Guantanamo and this issue of torture been?
Well, I think it's been enormously important. A good deal of Spiral is devoted to a discussion of torture and why it's important. It seems to me one of the signal aspects of what I call the state of exception that was imposed after September 11th, which is a more capacious term than state of siege or state of emergency or martial law. And torture is the most obvious way in which the United States basically violated its own strictures, its own laws. Torture is forbidden by international treaty to which the U.S. is a signatory, the Convention Against Torture, most notably. It's also forbidden in U.S. law, federal statutes as well. And the United States, of course, repeatedly tortured prisoners after 9/11, as many as has been documented in many reports, including most recently the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report, executive summary. You're quite right that when you look at one of these scenes filmed by the Islamic State, in which someone is kneeling on the ground in an orange jumpsuit, the black clad figure behind him is reading from a paper and then takes out a knife and beheads him. And we've seen these scenes a depressingly large number of times. That is a reference, that orange jumpsuit is a reference to the prisoners in Guantanamo. Most Americans seem not to realize this, but I would argue that, you know, if you live in the Middle East, you instantly realize that. If you're Muslim, you instantly realize that. And indeed, what happened at Guantanamo, where still 79 prisoners are living under indefinite detention, not having been tried, what happened in Abu Ghraib, what happened in the black sites where prisoners were tortured, probably over 100, had a very devastating effect on the U.S. national image, and also were enormously useful in recruiting jihadists. You only have to talk to FBI officers, counterintelligence people. Many of them will tell you, more recently, the case of Omar Mateen, who shot up the nightclub in Orlando, killing 49 people, and who said during the 9/11 call, the transcripts of which have just been released, why is he doing this? He's doing this because Americans are killing and abusing Muslims. And, this is the heart, the reason for radicalization as much as anything. We've convinced ourselves that this is a deeply strange mystery, the so-called phenomenon of radicalization. But it stems from, in most cases, the killing of, the abuse of Muslims.
Now, Mark, you also discuss in your book how the efforts by American elected officials like President Obama to claim that this is not who we are just ring hollow, particularly to the people who are the victims or related to the victims or the countrymen and women of the victims of our torture. But how is it that the U.S. Can declare and keep declaring this is not who we are? We are an exceptional country. We don't, we don't engage in the kinds of things that our enemies do, when clearly we have not just sunk to the same depths, but really dug the hole ourselves.
Well, it's a fascinating rhetorical phenomenon. And I think in using this phrase, it's not who we are, in a sense, President Obama reflects a widespread attitude among the American people that when these things happen, that they don't have to do with true Americanness. They are somehow these outliers that don't reflect the character of the American public or decisions made by American officials. They're not truly who we are. And I think it's a very revealing phrase, because it in a sense allows Americans to put a bracket around these things and to say, for this period of time, for these particular actions, this is really not about Americans at all. This is in some way, we've become something different. We don't have to think about this as characterizing our national identity. But at a certain point, who you are is dependent on what you do. And, again and again, we've done these things, whether it comes down to torture, more recently drone warfare, in which the U.S. has killed perhaps 5,000 people. Certainly some of those people were jihadists who were plotting attacks against Americans, attacks against the United States. Many of them probably were not. Certainly a significant percentage of them were so-called collateral damage, civilians who were killed. Others were simply killed because they conformed to a certain signature, as the phrase is. These were signature attacks, meaning that their activities seemed to identify them as militants, although we didn't even know who they were, what their actual identities were. So I think the drone program itself is highly questionable in what it does and who it targets. It's under no significant oversight, no oversight at all from the public. It's technically secret, even though the commander-in-chief, the president, has talked about it on occasion, because it remains, its status remains secret, off the record. It isn't discussed in oversight hearings. It isn't publicly discussed, even though, in fact, we know about it. So the government is able to remain in a situation in which they're not held responsible. This was similar. The torture program was very similar. I call this in spiral by the phrase public secrecy. That is, it's supposedly secret, but in fact, we know about it. Secrecy, the pretense of secrecy, only allows the government to escape responsible oversight and answer questions about it.
I mean, it's like Orwell's doublethink, where we almost have a plausible or try to have a plausible deniability with ourselves. Well, Mark, I just want to remind our audience that I'm speaking with Mark Danner about his book Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're going to keep Mark on for an extended conversation, which you can find in the premium content section of our website. Mark, you write in your book, the birth and growth of the Islamic State exemplifies a central theme of the war on terror, that across these 14 and more years of war, the United States, through its own actions, has done as much to aid its enemies and has sometimes helped create them. How do you trace the link between the U.S.'s actions and the Islamic State, not just in terms of how Al-Qaeda kind of led to the formation of the Islamic State, but in a way how the U.S. sort of very greedily laps up all of the ISIS propaganda to feed the continuation of the spiraling war? It's almost as though ISIS is this tailor-made organization to have this pretext for a war that has no end in sight.
Well, it is true that ISIS, the Islamic State, in effect is a kind of mirror image. The United States, in effect, created it through its invasion of Iraq, and also Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, its founder, was really given a worldwide stage by the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell, who talked about him very prominently during his famous appearance before the UN Security Council in February 2003 during the run-up to the Iraq War. Most people, I mean, the overwhelming majority of people in the world, including security professionals, had not heard of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi at that point. Colin Powell cited him as a key threat. And soon after the United States invaded and occupied Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, put in place an organization that began launching extremely effective bombings within Baghdad. Zarqawi bombed, for example, the United Nations compound in Baghdad. He bombed the Jordanian embassy. He was Jordanian by birth. He also bombed a mosque, a very prominent mosque in Najaf, killing the man who probably would have become the first prime minister or president of post-occupation Iraq. So they had from the beginning a very dominant political role within Iraq, and the United States essentially created them with its occupation. From the beginning, the Islamic State was made up both of Islamists and Ba'athists, people who had been displaced from their role of in the security forces of the government of Saddam Hussein. And that is the way the organization is still composed, a combination of Ba'athists and Islamists. And it's true, in a sense, to go back to your question, the Islamic State is a kind of forever extension to the original war on terror. I mean, it's kind of a stepchild of the war on terror, of United States efforts. And it is now has a worldwide footprint. I mean, it not only has significant territory across the Iraq-Syria border, which is the territory of the Islamic State, but it has franchises in 15, 16 countries, including a rising one in Libya in the aftermath of the overthrow of Muammar al-Qaddafi, which is an effort the United States also led. So we are talking about a perpetuation, and indeed the image of spiral is really about that, the idea that we're circling, getting farther and farther away from the goal of ending this war rather than perpetuating it.
Well, finally, I want to ask you, Mark, to talk about something that I think liberals and progressives are a little uncomfortable talking about, which is that eventually this war will catch up to us, even though to date there have only been a small number of American civilians since the September 11th attacks to be victims of these terrorist groups that we're targeting. Eventually that'll change. You write in your book about the Boston Marathon, and of course we saw the San Bernardino shooting, which is still being investigated, and the shooting in Orlando, which also still under investigation. Not clear exactly how directly involved Omar Mateen might have been with ISIS, but certainly knew to say the right things to the police to link him to the Islamic State. Eventually, will the chickens come home to roost? Even though, of course, we know the majority of Muslims in the U.S. are innocent, do not deserve the kind of surveillance that the U.S. is imposing on them on the inside, but there's eventually, if we continue this forever war, to quote Chalmers Johnson, there will be blowback, won't there?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think we're in a stage now where we've seen at least two major so-called lone wolf attacks. In September 2014, the spokesman of the Islamic State essentially appealed to all supporters around the world to kill the infidel. He said, you know, if you have weapons, use weapons. If you have your car, drive your car into people and kill them. Take a rock and smash their skulls. Just kill them. And this was an appeal for any supporters in countries around the world to take lone wolf action. And you saw such actions in France in the immediate aftermath of this statement, in Canada, in Australia. And we now seem to have seen a couple of them in San Bernardino and in Orlando. Whether or not the Islamic State is planning more spectacular or more devastating attacks on its own account to take place within the United States, we don't know. I think it's fair to say that as they come under significant military pressure in their home base, which is to say in Iraq and in Syria, which indeed has been happening. I mean, as we speak, Iraqi forces are retaking Fallujah, a key base for the Islamic State in Western Iraq in Anbar province. But as they come under more pressure in their home base, I think it's likely that you'll see more terrorist attacks abroad. I mean, it's a way for them to say that they're still on the ascendant. It's a way for them to call attention to themselves. It's, in effect, it's their strategic weapon. It's like the U.S.'s Air Force, you know, the use of terror abroad. So I think it's I would say that the odds favor more large-scale attacks and more attempts within the United States. Whether that's chickens coming home to roost or the simply the latest turn in this kind of forever war, is yet to be determined. But I think that the argument remains, which is that our policies since 9/11 and the 15 years almost since then seem to have encouraged a perpetuation of this war, not its ending.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for the book that you have written, very beautifully written book about a devastating topic. And maybe someday we'll have you on to talk about the end of this forever war. I hope that's true. Thank you so much.
I hope so. Thank you, Sonali.
Mark Danner is a writer and foreign policy analyst, contributor to the New York Review of Books, New York Times Magazine, and more, former staff writer at The New Yorker, and he teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as Bard College. We've been talking about his book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.